This is the Hermetic Hour, and I'm your host, Pope Runyon, and it is Thursday, May 12th. Tonight we're going to discuss a very important book on magic that's come out called Starships, The Prehistory of the Spirits by Gordon White, who is a journalist in London, originally Australian, I believe. And if he's not a cultural anthropologist, he certainly knows more than most of them who are, I'll tell you. And what this book is about, we're going to have Gordon calling in. This book is subtitled A Prehistory of the Spirits. And what he has done is he has taken all these recent, in the last, 50 years, these recent archaeological discoveries that the archaeological community and anthropological community do not want to admit, and these what we would call antediluvian prehistoric ruins that have been discovered, which indicate that civilization is a lot older than we thought it was back before World War II. And what he's done here is he's come up with a compendium of these discoveries and their implications. And the book goes right along with, although he's a chaos magician and we're hermetic, the book goes along with many of the things that we've been saying on the Hermetic Hour, and also it's a fascinating compendium, and I recommend it to everyone who's interested in this sort of thing. And it kind of, in a way, debunks Sitchin, and which I'm all in favor of myself, because Sitchin's a little hard to swallow. Yet it supports Jacques Vallée, it supports the Hamlet's Mill, Santa Anna and Van Decken. It supports the idea that these antediluvian civilizations, the pre-Ice Age maritime culture, this is what he's primarily dealing with. Gordon, are you on yet?
I absolutely am. Thank you for that lovely introduction.
Okay. Before we get into this, let me tell you a little something. The things that we share in common. You grew up on the Sepik River in New Guinea, my father was stationed in Wewak during World War II, and sent me a number of photographs of the Big Nambus tribe. And these are the guys with those great big penis cozies, you know. I think they're up the Sepik River. They're up the Sepik River, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. I wasn't actually, I didn't grow up on the Sepik River, but my father did. My grandfather ran it and obviously was there at Wewak immediately after the war, so they may well have met each other.
Well, they may very well have met each other. Now, going a little bit further on this specific thing, in 1988, I crawled all over Nan Madol, all over Nan Dawas, and even took a little dive off the breakwater. We even included that in our movie Beyond Lemuria, which you probably haven't seen, but I'd like you to look at it sometime. Anyway, when I was over there at Pohnpei, I spent some time with the resident archaeologist over there, and he told me that the Australians had, somebody from Australia had done an underwater video, and this was back before 88. It should be, somebody had done an underwater video of Kanabuiso, the sunken city that's right off the breakwater, supposedly. Do you know anything about that? I understand you've done some underwater videos.
Yeah, and I've done them there as well. No, I'm not aware of who that would be. It wouldn't surprise me in the slightest. But yeah, I'm not off the top of my head. That was a very fascinating place to visit.
Well, the legend of Kanabuiso, and you even have the two brothers. You mentioned the two brothers here in the book, but you don't mention the Pohnpeian version of it. But I'm sure you're familiar with it. With the two brothers that looked down off of Heaven's Reef, and they saw Kanabuiso underwater. It must have been February, because that's the only time the water's clear in that little lagoon there. But we one of a couple of our people 10 years later they dove in February, and we've got some photographs in our video. We have some photographs at a depth of 80 feet, which are kind of interesting. And as I say, when you look at the our video, you'll see. What was the underwater city that you did your video on? Which
no,
one
that
was it?
I've been to Ponape, so I've done that exact same dive. That was the main one. We dived in Ponape and Chuuk for that particular documentary. But no, I've been exactly where you're talking about, and been in the water there. And yes, it's a mangrove sort of ringed island, Ponape. So there's amazing diving off it, but right next to it, it's a bit murky, and you'd be familiar with the legendary stories of the city being protected by giant sharks, which isn't kind of what you want to hear when you're in murky water, murky tidal water. It's always in the back of your mind. These motifs are like the two brothers and the sunken city, and the use of magic and the falling out between the two brothers is a motif that you find right across the Pacific, which means we have to be very careful about kind of literalizing it. For my money, I do think Ponape in particular was occupied at an earlier stage than we currently accept. So that would mean, and also sea level modeling, particularly in the Pacific, isn't as good as everyone thinks it is. When you're talking about a large scale area, you can be reasonably confident about changes in sea level. But if we find things that are under the water just off Ponape, we certainly should be pulling the clock back. But it doesn't necessarily mean we have to go the entire way back. I suspect there the most interesting pieces of the story we're missing are probably like literally magical, given the prismatic basalt that the logs were made out of, that the sort of even just Nunn Madol is made out of. Some of them are between 20 and 40 tons. There isn't a crane on the island today that can lift them, and they come from the other side of the island. And it's a mountain.
Yeah.
I mean, you've been to it. Like, you can't. It's
they
along the rollers.
They fire. Excuse me. They fire broke them. They fire split them off of Sokin's Rock, and then somehow got them down there. Of course, they claim they flew them down, but you know, who knows how they managed it. Where can we find this video that you did on Kanamwiso?
Yeah. So I did that when I was still at university, and I have the original tapes downstairs. So we cut it together for an Australian sort of like a youth TV thing. It was called ABCI at the time. And so I gave them the copy that I cut together. And, you know, this was the 90s. So I don't have that. I only have the originals. And I brought them all the way to London because for the last 8 years, I've been thinking, like, I really need to cut this together. I mean, to be fair, I cut it together as a 20-year-old. I could cut it together better now. And I will at some stage, maybe even this year.
Oh, I
wish. And that'll just be really on YouTube.
I really wish you would, because the stuff we have at 80 feet, you got down. Of course, if you want to get all the way down to the bottom of that lagoon, it's a gas, it's a mixed gas dive, and neither Dr. X or I, when we did our stuff, we weren't going on mixed gas. But I very much like to look at that footage, and I know that you need to look at ours, and so. Let's coordinate on that after the show sometime and make sure we get, Yeah. And anyway, but to get back to the book, I found this book absolutely fascinating. And of course, I do have some questions to ask you about timelines and stuff like this that I find a little things. What happened? Which happened where and what happened when and that I have some problems with. But the whole book is an overwhelming study, and I just really find it absolutely fascinating. And of course, we have so much. Are your experiences and my experiences and our takes on it are so similar that I can't do anything but heartily recommend it. Let's discuss one of your most important concepts, at least from a magical point of view, that you have in here, is that before the flood, the Ice Age flood that we took, the 12, what is it, about anywhere from 12 to 15,000 years ago, before the big one that you're saying that mythology was stellar. Yeah, and after the flood, it becomes planetary. And I think this is one of the most breakthrough concepts, and I really, really agree with you. I got to reading that, and I thought, oh, this is absolutely, you know, this is absolutely terrific, Ben. And they've explained so much. And would you want to discuss that a little bit with us?
Yeah, absolutely. So we archaeology and history has kind of come through to us as disciplines out of sequence with other potentially very useful ones. So we sort of had archaeology before we had adequate chemistry to start doing things like carbon dating and so on. So all the pieces have spent the last 150 years coming through out of sequence. And that meant that people who were talking about, or really just guessing about, what ancient cultures were doing probably were making their guesses or forming their assumptions with an incomplete data set. And where the rubber really hits the road on that incompleteness is a lack of understanding of the role of the ocean in the human journey. So most of these kind of antiquarians, you're talking about retired vicars who are literally in the desert digging up Babylon. So the ocean is very far from their mind. However, if you just think about how we moved around the world, planets are not very useful. They're not very useful for navigators because they move, obviously, and they don't sparkle. That was actually one of the sort of Pacific definitions between what was a fixed star and what wasn't, was whether or not they sparkled. So they move, obviously, the inner planets move a little bit faster and spin back around and so on from how we see it. The stars don't. The stars are a clock. They're a clock that you can put stories on. So not only did we find it useful and getting better at star knowledge improved our kind of movement about the Earth, but the clocks could be used to time important cultural and spiritual events. And the sort of evidence for this it kind of comes through different channels, anthropological ones and so on. The mythological model I work to is one by Dr. Witzel, and it's essentially a family tree of mythology around the world. Now, if you look at what the work that's being done in Australia with traditional Australian cultures, which are the oldest cultures on Earth, like they're 50,000 years old. So they're quite a good ruler for kind of examining how far back we can we have certain concepts. And many of these cultures are profoundly stellar. They time a whole lot of different events to different asterisms and where they move and how they relate to each other. And interestingly, there is a recurrence of star lore associated with the same asterisms that we find today in sort of, you know, either Hermetic magic or Hellenic astrology or what have you, particularly around things like Orion, where 90% of all Aboriginal stories to do with the asterism of Orion are to do with a hunter or a hunting group. So we have the same idea, and that suggests very tellingly that big chunks of what we, like astrology factually, like a zodiacal planetary version of astrology factually is quite recent. You're sort of at that sort of 200 BC-ish mark. But the pieces that went into it, we can now look at and make a very reasonable assertion that some of the asterisms and some of the stories about star lore go back as far as we can see in the archaeological and mythological record. They begin with the stars, not the planets. And I think that tells us something very important about magic and its longevity.
Yes, I'm fascinated by, as I say, by this, by your breakdown between pre-diluvian stellar lore and mythology and post-diluvian planetary. We recently did a show centered around the legend of the Maskee, and this relates the Maskeem legend, with the planets that were originally conceived to be demonic because they came up from the underworld, The planets came up from the underworld. And remember, they had that old inscription, "Born in the bowels of the hills, evil ones, sowers of ills," you know, and whatever. And they came up from the underworld and then circled around. And this was so important in Mesopotamian mythology. This whole concept. And eventually the planets were rehabilitated. And became to have a positive aspect, but the zodiac, you know, and one of the books that you and I have both cut our teeth on was De Sant'Anna and von Decken's Hamlet's Mill, as you know, and I think you may or may not agree with me, but I think they sufficiently proved that the zodiac is, you know, at least 22,000 years old. The original concept of the zodiac.
I'm completely fine with that. Completely.
Yeah. Right. And the progress around the zodiac, of course, is legendary. Is the legendary labors of Hercules, and that, of course, is very, very old. But you remember Hermes said that the gods of the zodiac are eternal, and that man creates the gods of the earth sphere. And I think he was also referring to planetary gods when he said that.
Seconded. 100% agree.
Yeah, right.
You find the zodiac and the decans being more important. Like, these are the true powers of the universe. You find that in Hermeticism. And I think that is one of the many... I think that's one of the strongest survivals of actual Egyptianness into the Hermetic texts, because he does say that. I mean, it gets blurry because obviously it's a collection of texts that's created over several centuries, and it kind of moves. Some of them clearly move with the fads of the day, but there's unmistakable Egyptian DNA in the Hermeticism, which is the sky ground thing, which is more or less what Starships is about, and the prominence of the fixed stars or star law over the planets. I tend to agree with Hermes and view the planets as something of a hijack. Like, I get a bit Gnostic with this. And funnily enough, in the research for the book, Dr. Stephen Oppenheimer, based in Oxford, part of the Out of Africa Genetic Project, wrote a book called Eden in the East, which I think is a hugely important book people should read. And he noticed, looking at the different archaeological layers sort of going up from Samaria into Babylon, that at the earliest layers, the palaces are larger than the temples. And at the later layers, the palaces are smaller than the temples, and the temples are much, much larger. And you kind of see... I see a gradual political hijack, because if you can predict to the day when Mercury moves from, you know, going right to going left in the sky, and you can predict that several weeks out, you can demonstrate a certain cosmic power that sort of grows your terrestrial power. And I think a lot of the planetary stuff comes out of the mathematical machinations of potentially different priesthoods, and it's an overlay over something I think much more profound, much more invitational, and probably much more much deeper on a spiritual level, which is the sort of outlying stellar law.
Very, very, very much in agreement on that. And of course, as I mentioned, the labors of Hercules they're just as important as the as above, so below microcosm, planetary aspects in the microcosm and the macrocosm, and they've been, of course, interrelated with it. We have, I believe, we have Michael Beeson on the line. Michael, are you there?
I am, but I was hiding.
Oh, you were hiding.
We
okay.
were talking
well,
about
well,
it.
Well,
yeah,
yeah, you're, you know, Michael, you're hiding below the horizon. It is time to rise up. Okay, do you want to ask some questions for Gordon while we're on this subject?
Not really. I was going to let you take over with all the questions. If I ask Gordon any questions, it's just going to be something about sharks. So.
Oh, that's all good.
I know it is, but we'll wait on that till we have too much time. And
what, this isn't a shock hour?
No,
what?
It's not, unfortunately.
Well, unfortunately, with those sharks, yeah. Well, I have, I tell you, as Gordon knows, if you don't hit the lagoon off the breakwater in Non-Madol in February, if you hit it when I did, it's awfully dark down there. And I got down there and the ghost of the giant shark, I could feel it. And I got down to that first round top pillar, that everybody sees right off the breakwater, that first one that has the big bulbous top to it. And I got down to the bottom of that, and boy, then I felt this and I've been a diver for a long time, and sharks in dirty waters, are a nightmare that I've had. And I almost swam on the mouth of a giant hammerhead that way one time. So I got the feeling, oh, I got to get out of here, and I went up. And this concept of the zodiac and its symbolism preceding the flood brings up a question, Gordon, that I have. The way I understand the cycles of floods and sinkings and risings is that there were a number of them besides the one that we have that we seem to be centering everything on, the one about 15,000 years ago. And what I'm wondering in your book, because you're emphasizing Sunan land out there in the Pacific, and what a lot of us, left over from church word and a lot of us call Mu or Lemuria, you're emphasizing that as one of the main culture events. And are you referring to an earlier sinking and rising, or are you referring that to the one about 15,000 years ago? I know that I don't quite understand.
Yeah, so there are a number of things that present themselves for further speculation when you overlay the sort of density of flood myths around the world. And places that suffered the least amount of land loss at the end of the last ice age, so southern Africa being the famous example, have very few flood myths. And the part of the world that suffered the most land loss at the end of the ice age, which is island Southeast Asia or the Sunda Shelf, and that's an area of land where that twice the size of India went underwater, so it's not a small amount of land we're talking about, and also kind of the northeast part of South America, a big bit of land went under the water there. But in that case, you have this tremendous preponderance of flood myths right in the area where the most amount of land was lost. And yes, realistically, it would have been one event or several events, because you have three dryas phases going through the end of the ice age, the mechanics of which, if anyone tells you they understand where ice ages come from, they're not correct. And until we start looking at sort of solar rays and their impact on cloud formation. But we're kind of not allowed to talk about that, because that's actually a better model for the climate variation that Al Gore doesn't want you to know. But basically, there's a space weather component to it. So yes, I'm referring to like the one incident, which is the quote unquote the end of the last ice age. But that process, when you view it from geological eyes, actually took about 1500 years. There would have been some really, really bad days where giant chunks of ice sort of slid into the ocean and created mile-high superwaves and all that kind of stuff. So it wasn't a gradual rising up the beach. Some days would have been terrible. But in the case of Sumeria, for instance, where the kind of what we call the end of the last ice age sort of reached its final denouement is essentially the Arabian Gulf. And that was only about 5,500 BC. So we had a kind of flooding and then a recession and then an eventual flooding back to where the waterline is in and around the Arabian Gulf today. And that's exactly the point where Sumeria springs up. So we've obviously got these confusing layers. By the end of the Ice Age, depending on where you are in the world, changes the story quite a bit. When it comes to island Southeast Asia, where the preponderance of flood myths gets kind of an extra piece of evidence is through the genetics, which means we left Africa 70 to 90,000 years ago, followed the coast around and basically stuck there for about 30,000 years. Now, we throw these numbers around like they are something we can conceive of. 30,000 years is 15 Jesus lengths. And look at what we did in that sort of 2,000-year time. So that's an enormous amount of time. And then when you layer in the linguistic evidence, particularly Dr. Joanna Nichols' work, which dates, which provides dates for increasing and decreasing cultural complexity, what she found was that the first kind of incidence of increased cultural complexity outside of Africa, so once we left, was in the same area at about the 35,000-year mark. So you start to layer all these bits of evidence on a map, and then in the last 5 years, we have Indonesian archaeologists, MIT-trained, I might add, finding kind of carved hills in the shape of a step pyramid that has, a sort of bottom layer so far of 22,000 years ago. So we got pyramids, we got cultural complexity, we got flood myths, and we've got that with genetic contact back up into the Middle East and Africa, right where we lost the most amount of land. So I don't want to use the A word, because I really don't. But that strikes me as a cultural collection of cultures that were sophisticated enough to not only survive it, but also retain the story of that loss in their mythology. And I mean, I could take or leave my next statement, but at the moment, I currently think about two-thirds of our kind of antediluvian lost civilization myths, so essentially the Eurasian ones up to the north of Africa and into Europe, have as at least one parent something that happened in island Southeast Asia at the end of the Ice Age.
Yeah, the what I'm kind of looking for, and I don't want to, and I know you don't want to commit to something that you might later have to uncommit to. but what I'd really really like to see is in this book, and I was kind of like what De Santa Anna and Von Decken put in the end papers of Hamlet's Mill. They had a time sequence, you know, in there with all the signs of the zodiac and the years that they equipped. I would like to have an idea of whether Sudan lands sunk, whether it sunk and rose before Atlantis, or whether its sinking and rising was time frame wise in relation to the European. To our Mediterranean, right. And or Atlantic thing. That's what I'm looking. That's what I'm kind of looking for.
Well, okay. So the most of the land loss pretty much times to the year of a sort of 9600 BC that you would get to use the A word. That is when you sort of have a Younger Dryas Incident 1, and yeah. So it's in the classical Atlantean time frame, the sinking of Sunderland. Yes.
Yeah. All right. Now, and you mentioned the A word.
I did.
I got a master's degree in cultural anthropology, but I almost didn't get it because I used the A word occasionally. Really, literally. One cultural Marxist lady who was my archaeology professor, I made the terrible, in a symposium one time, I made the terrible the suggestion that we create an international anomaly bureau so we could, whenever an archaeologist discovered an anomaly, they would record it and photograph it in situ and send it to the anomaly bureau rather than throw it out. Or, as they usually, as the cultural Marxists like to do, they like to either destroy it or or, you know, or call it an insertion or something like that. And she just about, she almost asked me to leave the class. She was so mad.
Mm.
And I noticed that your
reaction. Yeah.
Oh yeah, your reaction in
the great sin of Marxism is But cultural Marxism relies on materialism, like Marx does. I'm surprised it's as popular as it is with spiritual people.
Everything has to evolve from the fundamentally complex.
Yeah, which is the opposite of what my book is saying. And it's the opposite of what, you know, most of our spiritual texts say. So anyway, I can see why that would have really violated her world, because it's not just anomalous archaeology. You're suggesting that her entire view is incorrect, which it self-evidently is, but that's not
Well, they weren't interested in when they excavated an ancient city. They weren't interested in the temples or the alignments or anything like that. All they wanted to do was dig in a garbage pit and find out what these people were eating. You know that? Yeah, they're really, really sad.
I know it's poor and, people. They only went. What do the poor people eat? Like, this is the thing. You go, well, poor people for most of history they don't do anything interesting. It's the kings and the crazy priests and what have you. So, you know, it's great to kind of get that information, but history happens to, the Queen of Sheba. It doesn't happen to whoever cuts her bread.
Yeah. Well, fortunately, at least in their approach, at least we found out about the bread and beer thing. And of course, we had a show a little while ago on the bread and beer conspiracy. You know, we both agree that the Anunnaki did not create human beings to mine gold. They created human beings supposedly to grow food for them. And from that, I think arose the bread and beer conspiracy, which you don't mention it as a conspiracy in the book here, but you do deal with it. We, for a long time, we didn't know which came first, bread or beer, but either one is a device to kind of combination mind control and slave food, which somehow or other got maintained in the biblical tradition, and that's another thing you mentioned, is that we went through a whole, before the Marxists took over, we went through a whole period where archaeology was primarily, what they were trying to do was validate the Bible and validate Homer, and that was what their main concern was, is let's validate the Bible and validate Homer. Yeah.
The same thing now. It's just materialism. So it's kind of the archaeology is the Book of Common Prayer to Darwin's Bible. Like it has to prove, even if they say otherwise, the assumption still has to be that we are in some sense better with our iPhones and type 2 diabetes. We're the best that the world can do. And if funnily enough, that's. And I like to look at the longer timelines of these things. You mentioned the A word. For the majority of Western culture, it was taken as self-evident that Atlantis existed. It's really only been the last couple of hundred years that we put a question mark around it, and now any discussion is banished. But most of the time, literally through most of history, like it was a self-evident that there are cultural survivals from before some kind of flood incident. And it's just become problematic for things like materialism. I think that's the real issue. And it's the issue tends to happen on a discourse basis rather than an individualized, say, archaeologist or historian basis. Because if you trap them in a room and say, you know, I have abducted your pets, we need to have a discussion about pre-dynastic Egypt, you'll find that you actually get quite a good answer. But they can't express it publicly, because that's where their bread is buttered, and I kind of rankle at that cowardice, but it is what's there. If you talk to historians and Egyptologists, the ones that have actually been out there, they know the sonic qualities of the temples. They know that there is absolutely no way that like a dolerite pounder has created these old kingdom statues from the second hardest substance on the planet. And they know all this stuff. They just can't say it. And it's disappointing, because it's a fun thing to say.
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. I had an experience, another experience from my days in graduate school, where I, yeah, it wasn't a confrontation exactly, but it was a kind of a kind of, it was. I presented my conservative Atlantis theory to one of these Gordon Child type archaeologists who had switched from, you know, the biblical orientation to cultural Marxist orientation, and I gave him the whole shot, you know, and well, how come, you know, the Lascaux caves and the Salmon Run and the fact that the chamber tombs get more and more older and more of them as you go down toward the you know, the seacoast in France and Spain and whatever. I gave him the whole shot and all the evidence I could come up with. And then I said, well, you know, we had a big storm and they kept building these dikes apparently around their central site, and then one big storm would flood them, and that'd be the end of it. And I used the Holland, you know, the storm in Holland back in the 1500s where the dikes were flooded in Holland, kind of like an earlier Katrina in a way. And I used that as an example. So I gave him my whole pitch, and you know, the guy, he was nurtured on Gordon Child and everything, and he looked at me and he said, yeah, he said, you know, you got a solid theory there, it'll work. So they will. If you get them individually and show them all this stuff, then sometimes they will agree with you. But they just don't dare.
Just not publicly. Yeah,
they don't dare publicly admit it. Michael, is there anything, I know you're hiding there, but is there something that you'd like to add to this?
No, sir, I'm just enjoying listening.
Well, okay. Then let me ask another question here. The title of the book, Starships. Gordon, you know, you and I both want to put down Sitchin, and we do want to get away from that. And why didn't you just use the subtitle, A Prehistory of the Spirits, instead of Starships? Because it seems like when you look at the title and you're aware of the subject matter, it almost looks like from the title, it looks like you're backing Sitchin up.
There's a full stop between star and ship. So there's the wordplay. It is the story of a sinking star's ships, stellar navigation, the colonization of the Pacific.
Yeah.
So in a way, it's kind of cheeky, which I enjoy. I enjoy the fact that it may accidentally land. And I want to be clear about how I feel about Sitchin. I think his model was extremely naive, but as a person, I actually quite liked him because I never met him, but I liked that he actually taught himself these ancient languages. And don't let anyone tell you again that, like, oh, he couldn't read or speak them. Like, he had his own interpretations of the words, but he knew what he was doing. Like, he could sight read hieroglyphs and Akkadian and what have you. He got caught in his own mythology. He was kind of trying to prove a sort of space Judaism, and it didn't really work, but he should at least get a hat tip for saying, like, this kind of official Sumerian story that we're being fed is nonsense, so I'm going to do my own. He didn't do a very good job of it, but, like, I'm a little bit sympathetic to him. However, the, mining gold to save the atmosphere of Nibiru model is not particularly good. I do think there's something very philosophically it is interesting on a philosophical level that it seems that a more sophisticated engagement with the stars in a ritual sense leads to increased cultural complexity and kind of access to knowledge that sort of jumps up and down around what would otherwise have been like this hypothetical linear progression. Now, that probably says something very important about the universe. And I think the sort of very literal UFO ancient aliens storyline is a realization that that's the case, but an inability to articulate it in a materialist milieu. So, I mean, Imhotep meant it quite literally when he said he was, you know, taken up to the moon and Thoth told him all these things about how you basically build the step pyramid. Now, if you read that incorrectly, and by incorrectly, I mean, if you read it in a materialist sense, I wouldn't presume to, like, you know, interpret people's mythologies for them. But if you read it in a materialist sense, you're just going to point at it and go, aha, aliens. And that's not actually what it's saying, even though Imhotep meant it literally. Like he, and that was kind of the goal of Starships for me. And I do make a point that I'm actually completely okay with the idea that physical extraterrestrials may or may not have visited us. They probably have in the 2 million years we've been in this form. I don't think it's here or there. And I think those kind of strange encounters actually happen too often to appear in mythology the way they do. That's the other thing. This is the very Jacques Vallée observation. But these sort of alien abduction UFO accounts happen, you know, dozens of times a day, and we don't get dozens of new religions forming every time.
We both, you and I, are fans of Temple and his serious mystery, I'm very taken with that, and I was very upset with the effort to discredit it, because I believe that represents Awanus, perhaps the fishmen of Mesopotamia, you know, the Awanus, the teachers that came up from the sea, and also the zodiacal constellation Capricorn and Vishnu and all of the various fishomorphic figures in our mythology, I like to think of those Dogon Omo as coming in a water filled spaceship, maybe, you know, swimming around in there and all that. I know that sounds, you know, like something out of Dick Shaver, but then on the other hand, it is an interesting concept, but I notice that you're very sympathetic of Temple.
I flat out think he's the best. I think he's the best in the kind of for want of a better word, like that sort of alternate Egyptology field. I think he's the best. He puts the time and the money into doing it. He's multilingual. He's extremely intelligent, and he's kind of unafraid to, and not unafraid in the sense of saying, look at me, I found the physical site of the Garden of Eden, like, and I don't care what anyone thinks. It's not that. He's actually boldly putting out, I think, very well-argued positions. So I think he's the best. I think he kind of zeroes in on the best model to kind of understand or to begin understanding the sort of megalithic complexity we find at the earliest layers of Egypt and the serious mystery. Again, he never once said people from planets around this star system came down and taught them that. He just said they knew this stuff about it. They're in communication with them. And you can take it forward, and you get alternate researchers now sort of looking at the depictions of the Nomo and other Dogon depictions. And it's what I call in the book redundant complexity. They appear to have received knowledge about the kind of shape of cells in the human body and that kind of stuff. And that, I mean, we understand that this is what happens when you do spirit contact. Sometimes you don't get what you want. Sometimes you get too much, and it you know, 1% of it is relative. So you either get the fire hose or nothing. And that, for me, is kind of why I wanted to write the book, because it seems like from a magical perspective, we can bring a maturity to this sort of analysis, which is like I look at the Dogon thing and I say, yeah, that looks like spirit contact, which for whatever reason is saying it's from Sirius, because you can kind of prove that they have things that they couldn't have otherwise got. And I think that's why Robert Temple is extremely smart, because he can see that and convey it in a way that doesn't get swivel-eyed.
Of course, in magic, as we know, you know, the speed of light is one thing, but the speed of thought is even faster. And mm-hmm. as our remote viewers have established, you know, and as we do in our work, we go out to these into the heavens and we do make contact, and as I said, you know, yep. using the speed of thought, and so this in a way kind of goes along with your Starships title. In fact, we even have ourselves a little winged boat that we use. That's for the little boat that spreads its wings and flies up off the altar. Which leads me to another one of our of the favorite people whom we share, and that's Jacques Vallée. And
the man of the
God. You warmed the cockles of my heart when I got a passport to Magonia. I thought, oh boy, now we're really in sync here. I've been, you know, whenever I get asked about this extraterrestrial thing, and I say, look, even Sirius, even nearby stars are so far away that you're going to have some kind of warp speed or wormhole or something like that. Which would be very, very compatible with an interdimensional theory,
it's by definition that. I think Jacques Vallée is, without hyperbole, one of the most important thinkers of the 20th century, and I kind of hope over the course of the 21st century that. That will actually show as we're right here at the limits. The sort of materialism is breaking. Physics is in real crisis. Basically, none of its models are working. So, I mean, how far are we from 50 years away from actually having a full reset that incorporates some of the ideas that Jacques by then would have been saying for a century? So I think he's going to be one of the most important thinkers of last century.
I can certainly agree with you on that. Michael, here again, but we're getting down to the end of the hour here, and I'm just wondering whether or not you might want to put something in here before we wrap up.
Okay, since you keep asking me to.
You know,
ask.
I'm not actually a shark, right, Michael? We can talk about them. You don't need to hide.
Oh, no, it's okay. So let's go ahead and go left field. Not exactly, though. Context. Limitations with spirits versus the spiritual experiences expanding the context of the experiencer and the communication. I want to hear you guys discuss that a little bit more, because it was kind of touched on clearly with when we get experiences, we get too much sometimes or not enough. But another example from your book was the kid who was grabbed and taken to a computer and mm-hmm. then shot back in, and how much one's context plays with interactions with the spirits versus what else is out there that they mess with you with.
Sure. Well, for me, this is kind of the key that makes me unpopular with ufologists and unpopular with magicians. Which is these phenomena present, and it's probably why, especially in the grimoire tradition, we have all these protocols about demonstrating the veracity of the actual spirit that has showed up allegedly to its name, because it is an unreliable phenomena. But as part of that, whatever their intention or groups of beings' intentions are, it's currently non-transparent to us, and as part of that, it presents in a way that we can understand. But I think, and this is interesting, I think it's something that dangles just on the very edge of our understanding. And you sort of see that in the development of the UFO phenomena over the last 65 years. But you can kind of interpret some of the probably UFO-ish incidents in recorded history as being similar. So this the example, which is from UFOs, The Psychic Solution, which is another Vallée book, this kid is abducted while on a college sort of weekend trip. And he's taken through perception of flying somewhere, lands on a hill next to, you know, the best idea of a supercomputer the early 70s can give you, which is this sort of enormous 40-foot shipping container style thing with tapes and whirring buttons. And he thinks he's there for a few minutes, up to 40 minutes. He comes back, it's 11 days later. His father's worked in the military, he probably doesn't anymore. And so he sent people out looking for him. But he comes back and he has a flower in his lapel, and obviously he's a male, so he'd shaved in the morning, but he's 11 days later and his beard hadn't grown and his flower was fine. Now that's a classic fairy story. That's a classic journey to the other world experience with spirits, gods, blah, 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 that you want, that comes straight from mythology, which is be careful, you might get lost or you might come back 100 years later. And all these things, we go, fiddle-dee-dee, that could never happen. Well, they do appear to happen. They happen within a context that demonstrates they're deliberately presenting a understandable face, but one that is slightly more advanced than us. And I find that stream of phenomena very interesting. But you can retroactively go backwards into, say, dynastic Egypt with that. There's a guy, Dr. Gregory Shushan's done some amazing work on looking at the similarities between near-death experience accounts and the shape of some of the sort of underworld journey mythologies that you find in the Book of the Dead and you find in Gilgamesh. And there are pieces that suggest that there is a deep structure underneath it. And there's quite clearly, I think, a deep structure underneath the similarities between UFO experiences and fairy experiences and Enoch and what have you. And as a result, that makes me quite I get everyone grumbling at me when I say that.
Let me make an observation here. We had Jake Stratton Kent on a couple months ago, and pointed out to him, I think that the underworld that he's so concerned about, the underworld became the overworld at the point when Hercules dragged Cerberus out of the hole, if you remember that. Then that seemed to be the break point at which. The underworld became the overworld for the Orphics and the rest of them, this of course is a phenomenon we've talked about tonight, about the Mas Kim as the planets rising up and from the underworld, and the zodiac, of course, also, you know, the Egyptian, your Egyptian speculations in here, and that knew it was both in the underworld and the overworld, as far as dimensions are concerned, it seems, especially as Michael Harner has pointed out in his Cave in Cosmos, which is wonderful, and Gordon, if you haven't gotten Michael Harner's Cave in Cosmos, I strongly recommend it. Boy, he had, you know, the Shamans have their three worlds. They have the underworld, the middle world, which we're in, and then the upper world. And it seems like this division, this three-world division, extends all the way back, to pre-Diluvian, antediluvian times, and of course, if we take the idea of the Enochian aethers, then we can expand this whole thing to 30 different levels if we want to, and then, you know, we have plenty of dimensions to have all these phenomena that both Jacques Vallée and Carl Jung have presented to us, and Charles Fort. Another thing that I want to mention in your book, as I know Michael Beeson knows, and I've mentioned a couple of times, I got started in this back when I was 16 years old, and I bit on Richard Schaefer, I go back to Richard Schaefer like I go back to the Oz books, you know what I mean? But anyway, you have in Starships here. You have a little section in here where you talk about a solar event, a very negative, very, very dangerous solar event, like a Carrington event that produced a lot of dangerous radiation in the Neolithic, and people in the Neolithic digging tunnels and literally digging underground cities to get away from the solar radiation. Now, mm-hmm. it's... And I read that, I thought, my gosh, this is something, this validates Schaefer, except all we got to do is just remove his Sitchin-like outer space and it validates exactly, you know. You want to escape the evil radiations of the sun, dig.
And exactly. Apparently they did all over the place.
So, this is what Jung would call, and Palmer himself called, racial memory. Schaefer's remembering this, and then he's using, the post-atomic age science fiction kind of mythology to justify it. But it's still, he was remembering something that really did occur.
Yes.
Yeah, this brings up the whole idea of that Carl Jung and Jacques Vallée are presenting about the angels and the UFOs and we could also say the demons and the Darrows and all of this is all coming out of our memory, and that would bring up Terence McKenna saying that that history is rolling up on us, we're sort of coming to the McKenna said we were coming to the end of history, and what do you think about that, Gordon?
I quite like his idea that the UFO is the object at the end of history. However, I mean, his timelines did kind of end. His time wave zero thing ended with something happening in 2012, which it didn't. But when you look at it from, I mean, he was basically a radical art historian, really. That was his sort of main area. And if you look at the increase in things like the increase in complexity and population and so on over the last 120, 150 years, it does appear to have passed an inflection point at some time. I remember Dr. Edgar Mitchell saying, my grandparents colonized the West in wagons and I went to the moon. Like, think about that. I mean, he's dead now, but that's actually what happened.
Yeah.
That is very interesting, and I kind of get to that sort of thing in the book, which is there is something about improving our relationship with the stars, and now we literally go to them in a physical form that does seem to escalate this complexity. And for me, there is to use the racial memory thing, for me there is something compellingly racial memory-ish about this process and about the fact that as universal a myth you like is that we got these tools of civilizations from the spirits, from the demons. So when we kind of get better, when we get a better telephone, we get more stuff from them. And that is something I kind of wanted to throw into the, if you want, magico-anthropological mix for how we begin to interpret history.
Yes. And here again, we're
we're in sync here on virtually everything. Before we go, Gordon, let's give you some promo here and get our cousin our listeners are going to want to they're going to want to get the books and reach you on websites and whatever. So we got Rune Soup podcast, which they're going to want to listen to. How do they get a hold of that?
All that information is at runesoup.com. That's the blog. That's the podcast. That's the contact details. Everything you could possibly want.
Okay, and the book, of course, is the Scarlet Imprint. Is the publisher of the Heartbound, and Bibliotech Rogue publishes the paperback version of Starships, and it is available on Amazon, I believe.
Not really. I'd encourage people to go to scarletimprint.com. The ones you'll find on Amazon will probably be more expensive. Scarlet Imprint's an independent publisher, and they don't publish any of their books through Amazon. So Bibliothèque Rouge is an imprint. So those ones, if your U.S. listeners are there, the paperbacks are printed in the U.S., so it saves on shipping and it gets too faster. But you'll get the best deal if you go to scarletimprint.com.
Okay, definitely. Repeat that right quickly so they can for emphasis here.
If you go to scarletimprint.com, that's where you can buy either the fine edition or the paperback of Starships. Every purchase comes with a ebook copy, which just gets emailed to you, so you can start reading straight away. But yes, if you look for them on Amazon, some of them will be sort of a couple of $100, and that's usually used or resold copies. No original Scarlet Imprint books are available via Amazon because they're independent publishers. Woo!
Okay, we got that straight then. And my bad for mentioning the A word. The other A word. Okay.
My other book's available on Amazon.
Yeah, this has been fascinating and absolutely fascinating. As I say, this book is near and dear to my heart, and I appreciate it. I want to get you I want to send you a copy of Beyond Lemuria so you can look at our non-Madol material. And then I definitely want to pursue the idea of looking at that, your non-Madol underwater footage, we'll pursue that via email. Next week, don't have anything planned, but as soon as I do, I'll get an abstract out to the usual suspects and you'll know what we're going to do next week. And next week, we'll have a hard time topping this one. And thank you so much, Gordon. And thanks,
been an
Michael.
It's been
as I said, you've warmed the cockles of my heart. So let's definitely get together and maybe if I can dig up some photos of the black of the big Nambus, maybe I can send those too. Okay, take care, be well, and good magic.